You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we do have a caller online. John from Port Jessup, you are on the air with Cliff Shackelford.
Hey, this is a curious question. I've just been noticing birds that normally aren't seen in this area. And the example was last summer, I saw a lazuli bunting.
Uh-huh, lazuli bunting.
And from when I looked at the bird maps and all that bit, they're not supposed to be around here.
Yeah, and actually that's a good sighting. I hope you got a picture of it. Where is Port Jessup? I don't know that area.
It's on Highway 6 between Manny and Natchitoches.
Okay, that might be a record for that area. So that's good that you took a picture of it.
I did not get a picture.
Okay.
It was last summer, and I haven't seen it this summer yet.
That might be a parish record, but let me tell you about lazuli buntings. They do stray eastward in migration. Very few spring migrations go by when, and sometimes in the fall, but mostly in the spring, where one strays into East Texas and we'll get one in there. And they're usually males because the females look just like the female indigo, pretty similar, but the males are so strikingly different that it grabs your attention.
Oh, no, they actually nested.
Oh, they nested. Well,
they nested in a nectarine tree I had out in my orchard.
Okay, well, that's probably, I'm going to guess that was a blue grosbeak that did that. Because
man, I looked after that, chased that thing around the yard for forever. And the closest thing this was last summer.
Okay, well, I can assure you that lazuli bunting did not breed there. That would be extremely rare. They don't nest this side of half of Texas, this eastern half of Texas, they don't breed. So the first year male...
I guess that was going to be my question. Have you all had more reports of unusual bird sightings?
No, I mean, it could be just a case of misidentification. And first year male blue grosbeaks will have that blue head and the look of a lazuli bunting. And I'm guessing that's what you had because they are nesting here, blue grosbeak. And I bet you that's what you had.
Summer?
Yes, yeah. And lazuli would be only a migrant, and they'd stick around for a day or two at most, and they would not be breeding here. No.
Yeah, the indigos have already kind of come and gone through here.
Yeah, and indigos, if you had them come and go, then they're still here. You just have to get into that right scrubby habitat or open pine forest that they like, and they're here. But look again. If you see it again, try to get a picture. Because if you have nesting lazuli bunting, you've got an incredibly rare find. You would have a migrant would be not terribly unexpected, but breeding is unheard of. So you would have to cough up a photo if that's the case. But my guess is a first-year male blue grosbeak. And what I mean by that is it takes the blue grosbeak 2 years to get the full breeding plumage. So this year, if you've got one that's got a blue head or you had it last year, he was born the previous year, and it takes him 2 years to get the full breeding plumage. We call that.
What's the difference in the size between a grosbeak?
Well, when he's sitting over there on the limb, size is irrelevant. That's really difficult to determine. But if you had it in the hand, the blue grosbeak would be a smidgen larger than the lazuli bunting.
Okay, one other question.
Uh huh.
It wasn't this year, but last year I saw a flock of common red poles. Come through Natchitoches.
Okay.
Isn't that pretty unusual?
It is, and there are very few records of flocks of those coming this far south. If you had a onesie, not even a twosie would be at a feeder, you would have tons of people come to look at it, be that unusual. So I'm guessing you had something else. Okay, that'd be another one you're gonna need to get a photograph of because, one common red pole is gonna be every 10 or 20 years or more. It's super rare, and a flock is unheard of. So, and that's the case when you're looking up birds and trying to figure them out. If you start reading that this is unheard of or that's unheard of, you might start going down a different rabbit trail because it's probably not the right critter. So I'm very confident that was not a flock of common red poles.
Well, I mean, red poles are pretty distinctive.
Yeah, they are. And
I have one more. My wife was driving down to Alexandria, and she calls up and says she saw flamingos.
Okay, and we get that call a lot, and they're pink birds. Those are all roseate spoonbills.
Well, that's even cooler.
Yeah, that is cool. And so locals call them flamingos because they're pink, but they're all roseate spoonbills. There are no native flamingos in the Gulf, on this north side of the Gulf. And occasionally one will get out of a zoo and has a big leg band, or, you know, there's a rare occasion, even in Texas, where we have had some wild ones, but they had leg bands from Mexico. They were banded, but most of the 99.99% of the pink birds you see in this listening area are roseate spoonbills. And those sightings really increase in the hot summer months, like around July 1 through August, September is when they really peak inland. Now, you go to the coast and you can see them right now.
One of my questions is, again, was, have there been more unusual bird sightings over the last couple of years because of whatever, climate change or whatever?
Yeah, there are always unusual birds showing up in places. And in Louisiana, you know, Cameron Parish is famous for that. But think about what they are. They're usually singles. They're usually not going to stay a long time. They're not going to be paired up and breeding. The really unusual stuff are going to be singles that are off track. Birds have wings. Birds get lost. Birds get sidetracked. They, you know, their compass gets flipped, so to speak, and they just turn up in weird places. And that's the beauty of looking at birds. You never know what you're going to see. But if you see something super out of place, you want to probably get a photograph of it first and then study it. Because if it's a one-day wonder, it's not going to be there the next day when your buddies come over to see your rare bird.
Hey, Bill, I just have one more question. I always like purple martins, and I have a perfect place. I have a farm on open fields, and no one in Fort Jessup area has purple martins.
Yeah,
they're all at Toledo Bend or down at Natchitoches. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, they're real particular, and the funny thing about purple martins is people get real excited when the neighbors have them, and they put up a nest box, or it might not be the exact next-door neighbor. It might be down the road or in the same subdivision, and they want to get them. Well, the area can only support so many purple martins, so I'm guessing somebody's got purple martins. There are very few areas around here that don't have purple martins, and the way to tell is if you master their call, if you get out at dawn, they're way up there, and they're chirping loud at first light. And I haven't been in many places in East Texas or in Western Louisiana where I have not heard purple martins. So I'm guessing somebody else has them, and that area can only support so many. So it's
I drive up and down Highway 6 and I see people with purple martin houses. I don't see any martins.
It doesn't guarantee you any purple martins. That's true. There are some areas that just won't ever get them. And I don't know the answer. I wish we could talk to the purple martins and say, hey, man, what can we do to make this area better for you? But you're right when you said around the lakes, I've seen lots of them around Toledo Bend and lake houses at Sam Rayburn. And then if you're within earshot of that, you know, or even a couple miles away, they're foraging in pretty big radius circles around those nest, those condos. But yeah, they're going to be places where you put up a deer stand, and doesn't mean you're going to catch a deer sighting, and you throw that lure out, doesn't mean you're going to catch a fish. And the same thing with a birdhouse. It doesn't mean you're going to attract a bird.
Well, I'm going to get my camera, you know, sharpened up, and if I see those weird little birds again this year.
Yeah, you're seeing some neat stuff. I'm glad you're hitting it hard.
What does that little bunting nest look like?
The bunting nest, all the buntings and grosbeaks nest, the indigo buntings are up in the bushes, usually about waist level up in a bush. Blue grosbeaks are usually in the grass. So they're going to be in a thick grassy area, usually on the ground or right near the ground.
Okay, these birds were up in, like I said, my nectarine tree, like 6
yeah,
7 feet high.
That's what's so weird. If they come back, take a picture and call back, because I'd be really curious what you had.
I'll keep my eyes open.
Okay, great.
And also, if you get a photograph or also a recording, you can send that in to us here at Red River Radio, And I'll give you my email address for everybody to send those in. It's also online. The email address is wbeckett, that's B-E-C-K-E-T-T, wbeckett, at lsus.edu. And then we will hang on to those for the very next bird calls and do our best to identify and have some fun with those.
Thank you for this show.
Great. Thank you. Great comments and questions. Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we hope that you'll call in right now. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist, and he is also the non-game ornithologist for the Texas Park and Wildlife Department. You can call in right now at 800-552-8502 and get your question on the air with him, or you can have our volunteers write it down if you don't want to go on the air. Don't be bashful. Have some fun. And also, you can make a pledge tonight as well. We'd like to get some support around this show, and you can do that either by phone or online at redriverradio.org. Just click at the very top of the homepage, you're going to see a big red button that says support this station. Click on that. It'll take you to our pledge form. And in the comments section, go ahead and write out your question. We'll get that into Cliff as well. And we're going to continue until 8 o'clock. He says he's ready to go. So we just need the call. So call in, folks.
And I really like the ones where we put you on the air live because
it's more fun.
Yeah, it's like calling the doctor. I got fever, doctor. What's wrong with me? Well, the doctor's going to ask follow-up questions.
Right.
And so it's really helpful for me to ask more questions and dig deeper into this question. So asking the doctor, you got fever, what is it? What's the diagnosis? That's not going to be easily done.
And so I'm going to put a question out here. I love to record natural sound effects. One, I use them in my job radio, and I've used them in documentaries and things like that. If I wanted to catch a lot of the native species around here in their early morning cacophony, the city birds, I presume, are going to be slightly different than the forest birds and the sounds. Where would I go? Where's a good hot spot?
The first thing I do is I'd get out of the city, because that's where you're going to have all the noise that you don't want. Sirens, dogs barking, traffic, airplanes, yuck, yuck, yuck. If you're really wanting to get natural sounds, you want to get as far from all that as you can. And the key would be to get to different types of habitats. Maybe one day go to the hardwood forest, the next day go to a pine forest, the next day go to a grassland, next day to the lake. And you'll just be surprised that every time you change habitats, you change, in a lot of respects, the suite of species that you have. There'll be some overlap, sure. There are going to be cardinals in just about every one of those, except the open water, of course. But all of a sudden, the mud flats is when you're going to get the killdeer calling.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes it easy. He says his name, killdeer, killdeer. So that makes it fun. And then the time of the day, you mentioned the dawn chorus. That is the best time. So as close to dawn as you can, as time goes on, at 10 in the morning, things get quieter. Noon gets very quiet. But birds are the noisiest right at first light.
Give us a call, 800-552-8502, if you'd like to be on the air with Cliff tonight. First, we have a writer called in, and it's actually a comment. A female caller said that bobwhites are back on their property after a wildfire. Is that typical?
Yeah, that's good to hear. So the wildfire creates that openness that they need. But another thing I didn't mention is that the bobwhite is really responds well to wet, dry cycles. So during times of drought, bobwhite just disappear. But as soon as some rain comes and you get the habitat right, so we've had a pretty good wet year, 2014. And so the prescribed fire that person mentioned and being a good wet year, it's just a really good prescription for bobwhite.
So it's a way of repopulating your area if they've kind of disappeared from there. So, but make sure that's a controlled burn under, proper authority and control.
Right.
Yeah, so you don't want to go out and set your own wildfires.
No.
You are listening to Bird Calls on Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, who is also the non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We have a question actually coming in from one of our volunteers, and I gave them a kind of a humorous answer to this question online, but they want to know why do some birds fly in formation, i.e. ducks and geese, and could it be for better flight dynamics?
And you said you already answered that?
Well, I gave them a silly answer. I said they're all in the military and they're well trained. So I'm pretty sure that's wrong, but it was having some fun here.
Well, in a lot of respects, it's similar to the Tour de France where cyclists are drafting. So you get some benefit by following a bird that closely. So of course you're going in the same direction or maybe to the same area, and so if you're a duck, or let's say geese are the best ones that show that formation, you're often benefiting by getting that uplift from the guy in front of you, the guy or gal in front of you. So that's a lot of the reason why they do it. And if you watch them, they don't keep that perfect V for long. It gets crazy shaped, mm-hmm. and changes to other letters and lines, but for the most part they're drafting and that does benefit them.
So it kind of cuts down on the friction that you're getting from the wind coming in.
Yeah, and so the hope is that somebody else takes a turn at the front of the line because he or she's the one that's breaking through the airspace first.
Teamwork is always important.
And the cyclists have learned this. So again, back to the Tour de France, you watch how they draft behind each other. Until the end, it's not about trying to get in the front. You're benefiting and you're actually saving energy. You don't really want to be that first cyclist.
Yeah.
You want to kind of be the next or the third and save a little energy and then make the mad dash in the last half mile.
So only one place you want to be that first cyclist, and that is the last 10 feet.
That's right.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we are taking your calls and questions tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're also taking your pledges tonight at that number, or questions and pledges online at redriverradio.org. Just click on the red support this station button at the very top of our homepage, and you can make a pledge and get your question in. We have Randy from Shreveport next. Randy, you're on the air with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Hi, Bill and Cliff. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hi, Randy.
Hey, I have a place on the lake, and the purple martins are back. And my neighbors have the houses that they like, but they also like the wiring inside of my boathouse, and they roost there and create quite a mess. I was wondering if there's any way I could encourage them to sort of stick to their houses.
Well, so they feel real safe and secure under that roof. They're out of the harm's way, so to speak. If there are any nighttime predators, they're not out in the open. Bad weather, they're safe. So really, you've provided them with all that safety and security. So is there a problem that there's a lot of poop on the ground the next day?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Poop on, they're like poles, you know, where we have boat lifts, and so they roost and sit on the poles, and they're basically chalky white.
Right.
Into the summer every year.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't close down the doors and the windows on that place, I would say your next best thing is just to put out drop cloths or sheets or plastic tarps that are anchored down, you know, because of the wind with bricks or ties or something, so it doesn't blow away. But otherwise, you've created this great bedroom for them, and you can't blame them.
Right.
You know, birds want to feel safe, and they probably get a really good night's sleep there on your boat dock. So, and they're good neighbors to have. You know, they're beautiful to hear, and they eat some pesky insects. They do eat a lot of dragonflies too, and one of the early advertising campaigns was that purple martins eat all your mosquitoes. Put up a box. Well, actually, we learned that they're eating more of the predators you want to have. Mosquitoes are really hammered by dragonflies, both in the larval stage in the water and the adult stage. So actually, that advertising campaign is probably 100% incorrect. Or not 100%, but pretty doggone incorrect. So if you're overrun with mosquitoes, you want to have dragonflies. They're your best predators of harmful insects, harmful but pesky insects like house flies and mosquitoes. But still, purple martins do eat their share of insects. They are good neighbors to have. And I'd say, you know, you'd have to take the wires down if you don't want them in there. There's really nothing you can do if you can't close the doors on your bay there.
All right, well, thanks very much.
Thanks, Randy.
My call, and I really support the show.
Great,
you're doing
thanks.
A great job.
Excellent.
Thanks so much.
We
thanks,
appreciate
sir.
That, and we hope everybody else listening now. We still have some time tonight, and you can call in right now at 800-552-8502 and get your question online with Cliff Shackelford. Or you can go ahead and just tell our operators, our volunteers, that you'd like to have it written in, and we'll send it into Cliff. Right now, we have a caller who states that a bird that looked like a hawk, medium-sized, light color, broad wings, was seen near a rail yard that looked like it was eating pigeons. What kind of bird might this be, and could it be eating pigeons?
Yeah, we talked about the Cooper's hawk earlier,
okay.
The blue darter, as they're called often, and they really hammer pigeons. They like them. They taste good, and I would bet that they had a Cooper's hawk. They're the right size, and they catch birds on the wing because a pigeon is very difficult to catch. They're fast and crafty, so a Cooper's hawk would be one of the few birds to do that. So next time that happens, go look to see when he's pounced on it and he's starting to eat it and tear it apart. Go see what you can see, but I'm guessing Cooper's hawk.
Well, give us a call at 800-552-8502 if you'd like to be on the air with Cliff Shackelford, our resident expert on birds. He's a non-game ornithologist with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and he is our resident expert tonight here on Bird Calls. The number to call again, 800-552-8502. You can also make a pledge at that number, or you can pledge and send your question in online at redriverradio.org. Just go to the Support This Station button at the top of the homepage, and you can make your pledge there, and go ahead and write a question in the comments section. We'll get it into Cliff. So we're going to Dawn next from Nacogdoches, Texas. Dawn, you're on the air with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. I'm visiting my daughter in Nacogdoches, and my bird questions come from Corpus Christi, Texas, which is where we live.
Okay.
I have just some backyard bird feeders. We're in the city, about a half-acre lot, and I always have a cardinal pair,
mm-hmm.
And I've seen some juveniles on occasion. So my question is, you mentioned that the young bird was probably born pretty close to where you see him.
Mm-hmm.
So do mom and dad leave and leave that territory to the young bird, or does he have to go out and find his own?
Yeah, usually it's like the 18-year-old that gets kicked out of the house and has to find his own way or her own way. So that's similar in birds. So usually the breeding pair will maintain that territory, and the young ones then become what we call floaters, and they float around looking for a vacancy or looking for an unmated pair. Maybe there's a single out there, then they can complete the pair. So those floaters look around for that territory that's unoccupied. You know, birds don't live that long. Like a cardinal, there might be records of them living 8 or 10 years, but probably averaging 4 or 5 maybe. So there's constantly vacancies out there, unoccupied territories where they could call home. So what other kind of birds do you have in your yard in Corpus?
Oh, I mean, I have the standard, finches and the all of the doves and all of the pigeons. I've got anywhere from 5 to 11 pigeons that frequent my feeder. I've got starlings this year, a large number. I've just had occasional. I guess my favorite ones is I've had, one summer I had parrots or parakeets.
Okay.
Show up on occasion. You know, I assumed when I saw one that it had just escaped. And then I saw like 2 and 3 together, and I'm like, oh, a lot escaped.
Yeah, those are probably monk parakeets. And Corpus is a birding mecca. I don't know if you knew this, but it's been named the birdiest city in the country for several years in a row. And you have a lot of really neat spots to go, little hot spots nearby. If you've been to Packery Channel, that's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Blucher Park, which is right downtown Corpus, that is a hot spot in migration. So 4 weeks ago, I would have really encourage you to go to Blucher Park, because a lot of these migrants stop off there, and you can see all kinds of colorful birds, tanagers, grosbeaks, warblers, vireos. But if you go right now, it's pretty dead. Migration is almost done. But try going to Blucher Park next April. It is fantastic. And if that's within a short drive of your house, you're really lucky, because Corpus has a lot of really good hot spots.
Everything in Corpus is close.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. I mean, and the neat thing is driving that loop, going to Aransas Pass, taking the ferry over to Port Aransas, and then driving along Mustang Island and then over the causeway. That, if you do that tour and make some stops, you'll just see you can see 100 birds easy in a day in spring, just because you cover so many different habitats in that big loop. So that's great.
Right. Well, we really enjoy it, and I put out my thistle feeder trying to attract goldfinches, but I think I was too late. And they may not even be in South Texas. But the other thing, I do keep my hummingbird feeders out all year round.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to, instead of one big feeder that, you know, holds 8 or 16 ounces, I went to the little individual ones that hold like 3 ounces.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got 5 to 7 of those. And I do have, like I said, I have the hummingbirds all year round.
Yes.
Usually the Rufiuses. You know, he's pretty plump by the end of the winter.
Right. Yeah, and you have also buff-bellies will be in the Corpus area. That's a big hummingbird. He's very tan, very aggressive. And I like to hear that you have, what'd you say, 5 feeders? Because a lot of times...
5 to 7.
Mm-hmm. That's great, because a lot of times hummingbirds get very aggressive towards each other, and that feeder's mine. No, it's mine. Leave it alone. Stay away. It's mine. So if you have multiple feeders, use the house kind of to block the view from the other feeders. That way they can't sit up on one point and see all 5 feeders. You want to have it where it's difficult for them to maintain or police all 5 feeders. But that's great that you're doing that. And also it's great you came to the Piney Woods, because we have a lot of birds here that you won't find in Corpus. You have brown-headed nuthatches and pine warblers. There's a lot of things here, and in the greater Piney Woods area, prairie warblers breeding, swallowtail kites that you won't have breeding in Corpus. So, yeah, it's neat that you have the two places to go, because the bird life is quite different.
Yeah, we took a walk on the Lanana Creek Trail
yesterday
morning and saw a water bird, but looked, I'm not seeing it, and I didn't have my bird books with me. But it didn't look like a duck, so it was some type of long-necked, not real long-necked, like a crane. But anyway, I'm like, oh, this is so cool.
Yeah.
Anyway,
neat.
On the hummingbird, you'd mentioned nesting, and I just always assumed that they nested somewhere else. So what is a nesting pair? How do you figure if you've got a nesting pair?
Well, if you watch the male, he will never lead you to the nest. Remember what I said about how they're deadbeat dads. So you really want to watch the females. And then they're pretty stealthful. They don't want to really draw a lot of attention to the nest, but typically for nests of a ruby throat is going to be in the outer edges of a tree, fairly low, maybe 6 to 15 feet off the ground. Usually 10-ish feet off the ground is where they are. And you really just have to watch the females. Now, in the Corpus area, you could even have black chins nearby nesting too, and buff bellies that I mentioned. So you have a greater diversity. And because you guys are really mild, because of the proximity of the Gulf, that is a really good spot for getting a lot of wintering hummingbirds. So I'm glad to hear you mention earlier you keep your feeder up year-round, because the really neatest hummingbirds are going to be in the colder winter months. But, you know, it doesn't really get that cold there. So it's really, really conducive for an overwintering hummingbird to stick around, and the feeder really helps.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio tonight. It's a special edition. We're asking that you call in with your questions. Also, if you can, we'd like you to make a pledge around Bird Calls tonight and help us out and raise support for Red River Radio, and also to bring these programs to you, all of our local programming. The number to call, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You can go also go online to redriverradio.org. At the very top of our homepage, you'll see the Support This Station button. Click on that, go to our pledge form, make a pledge, and you can fill out your question in the comments section down there, and they'll shuttle those into us. We would be happy to have all of your questions come in, as well as your support tonight around Bird Calls. We're going to go to Rusty next from Bossier City. Rusty, you're on the air with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
You were talking about the purple martins and the insect feeding earlier, and my question has to do with your concept of bats. I know he's not a real bird, but what about the bats as far as keeping down insects?
Yeah, he's not a real bird at all, is he? He's a mammal.
He's a mammal.
Yeah, and let me tell you, there is a group based out of Austin called Bat Conservation International that has really helped put bats on the map, showing for people in the agriculture industry how much bats, namely the Mexican free-tailed bat, consume every night, insects that are harmful to crops, things that we like to eat. So bats are incredibly important, and in other parts of the world, they're important pollinators, important for the plants. Yep, you'll get these long-nosed bats and long-tongued bats that will pollinate plants out west, like in the Big Bend area or in places in Mexico. A lot of those species of plants are tied to bats being the vectors of pollination. So they come in and eat the sweet nectar. The plant gives this treat of sweet nectar, and in exchange, that bat, just like a butterfly or hummingbird, takes the pollen and takes it to a different individual and helps in the pollination process. So pollinators are important to us. If you like to eat, and I do, we need to respect our pollinators. The bats that I mentioned, the bees, the butterflies, the hummingbirds, they say that about every third bite out of our diet is going to be because of a pollinator. So if you're seeing in the news about decline in bees and you think, oh, big deal, it is a big deal. Yes. If you like to eat. It's a huge deal. So, but the bats, I'm glad you brought up bats. Actually, this is a bird show, so we're not supposed to talk about mammals, but we'll do it.
Betsy. They fly. We'll let them in.
We'll accept the bats. So they're good. They're good friends to have. But yeah, if you want to find out more about bats, I encourage you to look up Bat Conservation International, based out of Austin. And they've had to dispel a lot of the myths, you know, because of poor Dracula movies and vampire movies. They really made a bad thing out of bats. And yeah, bats do get rabies a lot, but in general, they're good neighbors to have. Like I mentioned, they're eating a lot of harmful pests up high in the air, and they're really important to have.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He's with us tonight for another 34 minutes to take calls, 24 minutes rather, to take your calls and questions about anything having to do with our avian world and the occasional bat call as well. And yes, if you like Tupelo honey, preserve the bees, because I love Tupelo honey. There's no other honey like it. So, and I know bees are essentially crucial creating Tupelo honey. We have Walter is on hold here, and we're going to keep you there for a couple of seconds, Walter. We've got a couple of written in questions here. Henry from Shreveport wants to know what type of feeding strategy for birds in the summer months, what type of feeders and birds, etc., should he engage in?
I would switch to a bird bath in the summer. Okay. I would switch to a bird bath. There's less water. Birds need it for bathing and drinking. I mentioned wildscapes earlier. You want to encourage plants that give back to wildlife. I would shut down the feeders. Actually, I'm glad you brought this up. We Parks and Wildlife just did a big news release probably today or yesterday. We've been getting record numbers of calls of dead cardinals in the backyard. And the ones we've tested all came back with salmonella poisoning and also aflatoxin poisoning. So, and that's a problem. That's a human problem. We don't store our seeds correctly in the hot, sweaty months. So here in the Deep South, I would shut down bird feeders except for the hummingbird feeders, but the seed feeders, instead, put out the wildscape. Make sure you pick things that provide food for the birds and let them eat that naturally.
You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you have a question and like to go on the air with Cliff, or we'll write it down and bring it into him. Don't let fear of going on the air keep you from getting your question in. Walter from Hallsville, Texas, you are on the air with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Are the big, tall woodpeckers still around? I mean, I've seen them up to a year ago.
Yeah, there is a big, tall woodpecker that's around called the pileated woodpecker, mm-hmm. and they are still around, and they're very vocal. I've got them in my backyard. I love them.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, one thing we did, we had a water oak tree die. It was a mature tree, big tree, and we saved money by having the tree, of course, removed, but we left 19 feet of the trunk from the ground up to 19. The reason 19 is because I measured, if that tree fell over, that stump fell over, I measured it was 21 feet to hit the part of the tip of the patio. So that tree would have to actually hop a couple of feet to hit. But we left that for the woodpeckers, and the pileated's come. Now that it's been about 3 years, that tree is decaying. We save money by not having to haul all that off, and it's pretty cool to watch the pileateds come and drill and excavate in there for insects. So a lot of people think that woodpeckers kill trees, but they don't. The tree is already stressed or dying or dead, and the insects come in and do their thing with decomposition. Decomposing that tree, but the woodpeckers are responding to that. They're coming into the insects. So, yes, the answer to your question is the pileated woodpecker is still around and doing well.
And I've got one more little question.
Okay.
Does it hurt to feed the – I feed my dogs. I got a wolf, and but I feed them dog food. The crows come in and help themselves, too. Is that going to hurt my crows?
I've not heard of any problems with dog food, and I know that a lot of blue jays and crows will come in. Some areas where we have great-tailed grackles in the city, they'll come and eat dog food. I've never heard of problems with that. Probably because we go through the dog food pretty quickly. Seed is usually stored longer. It goes through slower. It's been in a sweaty sack for a long time, no telling how long at the store and it's in transit and so forth. So dog food is probably not as much of a problem. And maybe that's a case of some preservatives. I don't know. I'm not a dog food expert, but maybe there's something involved in that versus a natural seed might be a little different. So. But, yeah, I think that it's probably okay to have the occasional crow stealing some of the dog. What does a dog think about that?
Oh, I feed them. I try to share it with everybody.
Okay, so.
wolves and crows are my friends.
Okay.
They're about the only two-legged friends I got.
So old Roy doesn't mind that the old crow's coming around.
Oh, no, I feed them the puppy chow.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good.
See, some of the dogs are allergic to the grains in the dog food.
Huh, that's true.
They lose all their hair.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
And most people don't know that.
Yeah, that's weird, huh?
It is. Yeah. I just wonder what they're doing to us.
Yeah, exactly.
What they think is food, you know.
Yeah.
I'll get off that. It's a whole different subject.
Yeah.
Right.
But we sure appreciate you. We've got to take care of our friends.
Hey, thanks for the call, Walter.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We appreciate the call. And if you'd like to call in tonight, 800-552-8502 is the number to call in. 800-552-8502. We still have about 19 minutes left in our show. We've got about three online questions to go to right now. The first one is from Diane from East Texas, who would like to know how to get the breeding hawks back after the wildfires.
It's tough when people have an increase in rodents or squirrels and they want to get raptors back. It's not that easy, and I don't know how to tell people to encourage to get raptors back, birds of prey. It's just not something we can control. So it's usually determined on how many there are out there and where they decide to settle. And I don't really know what else to say on that. It's one of those things that's kind of like my comment on fishing. You don't, just because you throw that lure out doesn't mean you're going to catch anything. Well, there's not really a lure you can do actively to try to encourage raptors. You just have to, they're a top predator. You just have to hope that there's the plethora of prey items for them to come in and chow down.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. And we're taking your questions and calls tonight. 800-552-8502, the number to call. Again, that is 800-552-8502. If you'd like to get your question in, we still have time tonight and we can put you on air, or we can write out your question. Also, if you get a chance and would like to make a pledge, we'd certainly love to have it tonight. Cliff would love to hear from those pledges as well. We'd like to raise some money around Bird Calls so that we can continue to do this kind of thing. You can help out right now. Again, 800-552-8502. Or if you'd like to go online and make a pledge, go to redriverradio.org and make your pledge there. Just click on the red support this station button at the very top of the homepage, and then you can write out your question right on the bottom of the pledge page in the comments section. We have a pledge from Woodville, Texas. We'd like to thank that person. They chose to remain anonymous, but they know who they are, and we are very appreciative of your support of our program tonight. And we have a couple of questions that have been written out here. One is from Darby from Woodville, Texas. Writes that she wraps a PVC pipe around the clothesline to keep squirrels away. Can that also work for birds?
It can. It's the thing it does is it constantly rolls if the critter is big and heavy enough to do that. Or if you put a big gauge PVC and it's a small bird, he might not be able to grab hold. That might work, but if it's a small gauge PVC and a big chunk of it, and you're a tiny little bird that weighs the same as, you know, a purple martin's gonna only weigh about the same as three coins in your pocket, it might not work. But a squirrel, of course, is going to be enough weight to make that PVC roll around. The problem is the birds are very light and it might not work. So I would say maybe try a bigger gauge PVC, but then that means it's going to be heavy. Then that means it's going to be sagging on your wire and stressing your poles. So it probably is not going to have the same effect on birds as it does squirrels.
You're listening to Bird Calls tonight from Red River Radio, and we hope you'll call in. We've still got about 15 minutes left. We can take your calls at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 to get on the air with Cliff Shackelford and ask a question. We do have an online question here from Pierre from Bossier City. Wants to know how birds synchronize their flying in formation.
Well, I think it's just all the way it works. I don't know that it's synchronized as in choreographed, as in practiced, as in someone telling them left, right. It just happens. There's no choreography going on.
So it's unlike a school of fish where they all kind of dart just, in the same direction. It's not that unified and genetically connected.
Well, it just happens. I think that birds move pretty quickly, and so if the guy in front of you moves left, you're going to move left. But not all the time. Like I mentioned earlier, those V formations don't stay V for very long. It'll turn into a W and a flat line and then an M, and it's just anything goes. But no, it's just the way it just happens. There's no explanation for it, no choreography.
All right. Well, we still have time, folks, and no calls and questions right now, so the lines are open. Everything is open. Give us a call, 800-552-8502, and let us know that you'd like to ask a question with Cliff, and we'll get you on the air. Or you can go online to redriverradio.org, make a pledge, and in the comments section of the pledge form, go ahead and ask your question there as well. I've got a couple of more sounds loaded. Again, this is from that backyard, what do you call that? The long recording.
Okay.
It's about 15 minutes long, and let's see if there's anything different in this collection.
Okay. Still house sparrows.
And the one chirping kind of,
yeah. There's a robin in the distance singing, and that's what I'm hearing way off in the distance. Dilly, 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 dilly. That's a robin.
Okay.
But the rest are all house sparrows.
All house sparrows.
Making those chirps. And, yeah, it's not my favorite bird song or bird call.
Well, I seem to have a lot of them around my place.
Yeah.
So, and starlings in my roof. So I've got a lot of birds with S's in them hanging around here.
Well,
so
maybe next time go out to the Red River National Wildlife Refuge and see what you can record there.
Yeah. I haven't taken my recorder out, but I like to go out to Lake Bistineau quite a bit and just wander through the woods and find a nice place, log or something to sit on, and then I'll just set the recorder there and just chill for a while and let the, you know, usually when you're walking through the woods, things will kind of modulate, and sometimes they modulate and quiet down, and then you just have to sit still for a while and they'll all start singing again.
Yeah.
And you'll hear the same thing. It's getting out there early in the morning that's
the problem.
Because to get out there, I'd have to be up about 4 a.m. in order to be out there about, you know, sun up.
They won't let you call that work? You can't clock in and do that?
I probably could, but then sooner or later, Kermit's going to... Bill's never around here. He seems to be recording birds all the time.
Yeah,
I wonder about
that. I like
that.
I would approve that request. So.
Well, I do go out there a couple of times a year, and like I'll stay in the cabins or something like that. I'm a little rusty for, you know, floor and tent camping. My bones don't work so well, but they've got some nice cabins out there and they're pretty comfortable, so I'll go out there and just get away for a weekend or something like that and take my recorder out there. Well, we have a comment that came in online regarding recycled plastic for hummingbird nest. There's an article about this in the June edition of Scientific America, or American, and they wanted to know what you thought about that.
Well, I don't like the idea of plastics in any bird nests. I didn't see the article, but I'm thinking of osprey nests in the north, northern Great Plains, where there's a big problem with hay bale string cord that's nylon, and the ospreys unknowingly weave that in their nest. Well, the nestling, he's there for 3 weeks or so and eventually gets tangled in it and can never get away. So that's my only problem with plastics is if it's in long pieces where they get stuck in it, like fishing line. So I need to see this article to see if they're saying it's good or bad, but... You know, birds didn't use plastic 100 years ago. Why do they need it now? I would say that especially hummingbirds, they're going to use a lot of plant matter, and they're going to adorn the nest with lichen and moss to keep it cryptic and camouflage. And I don't think that plastic anything would really help with that. It doesn't breathe like natural fibers. Again, not having read the article, I don't know what they're promoting, but I don't like it. I would say it's not something you want to do. So what some people do is they'll put out an old seat cushion that's ripped open, and the cushion is coming out that's got cotton or some kind of filler, and hummingbirds will use that. And that's, I don't think there's a problem with that, especially if it's a natural fiber like cotton. So maybe polyester that's fluffed up like cotton, that could be used, and I don't see a bird getting tangled in that. And so some people do use that, but I'd say stick to natural fibers for that, and hopefully the birds will too.
Give us a call at 800-552-8502 if you'd like to be on the air with Cliff Shackelford. He is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and also the non-game, statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we'd like to have at least one or two more calls. We have a call online right now, or an actual question from online right now. Andy from Hainesville asked, if the mockingbird's calls differ from region to region, is there a regional dialect?
Well, that's a good question, and they do, because remember, most of the dialect of the, or not dialect, but the components of a mockingbird song are things they hear in their environment. So if you hear whippoorwills and you're in Pennsylvania, you're going to make that imitation, because that's what the mockingbird's doing. He's mocking the birds because, hey, I can do your song and about 30 others.
Mm-hmm.
You're only doing that one. I can do 30 or 40. So he's kind of making fun of them. And the Latin name is Mimus polyglottis. So that specific epithet, polyglottis, means many-tongued. So that translates to the many-tongued mimic, which is pretty cool. Many-tongued means singing. He can sing lots of songs. So, yes, the answer is yes. We're, depending on where you go, what the sounds they hear in their environment, they'll imitate. So if you have a squeaky gate or a certain car alarm in your neighborhood, I've heard mockingbirds imitate those sounds.
Really?
And that might not transfer 10 blocks away or 10 miles away. So, and then the whippoorwill call, the comment I made about Pennsylvania, if you live in Corpus Christi, like the caller earlier, there aren't whippoorwills there in the breeding season. And so the mockingbirds are not sounding like whippoorwills. Instead, they're sounding like parakeets and chuckwills widows and other night birds that they hear. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting to listen to the mockingbird and see what he's hearing too. Yeah, here's a mockingbird. And usually they make the imitation in threes, and that really helps. So if you hear, things, in, three, three, threes, it's a mockingbird. So if you hear it in twos, it's a relative called the brown thrasher. And if you hear just singles, it's usually a gray catbird, and their volumes are different. So a gray catbird's very soft and quiet and says everything once. The brown thrasher's pretty quiet and says everything twice. But the mockingbird, he's loud. He says everything in triplicate.
That was an Alabama mockingbird in Huntsville, in case you're wondering, from the dialect. So, all right.
Crimson Tide.
We do have a call online. John from Nacogdoches is online. John, you are on the air with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Thanks. I just discovered the show and thought you might be the one to ask. We have a nest of red-shouldered hawks next to our driveway that we've been watching. They have two little ones that we've been watching go from all white with big eyes to getting black now and bigger. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what to expect. Are they going to fly out, come back? Are they going to fly once and leave? Will they? What's the next step in their life cycle?
Well, most raptors do what's called branching. The young birds, that means that they'll venture out of the nest and out the limbs and stretch and practice. And that's what we call branching. But typically what they'll do is when they're ready to fledge, they'll just make a flight out. And if they're strong enough, eventually they could fly back to the nest later that day or maybe the next day, because there's still comfort with that nest. And also they associate food with that nest, because guess who's been bringing and delivering food to that very spot? So, but after several weeks and weeks go by, they won't use the nest at all. So let's say July, August, there won't be any activity at all at that nest. Those young birds will be working on their own, watching the parents, figuring out how to feed, and they don't need those deliveries brought to them anymore.
Will they live nearby while they're doing that and watching the parents, or will they
be gone? Usually the young will be with the parents for a while, and it's hard to say how long, but then eventually they've figured things out. Mom and Dad have done a good job teaching them how to survive as a red-shouldered hawk, and then they'll go out, and I mentioned the word floater earlier. They'll just become floaters, and they'll go out and do life of the red-shouldered hawk on their own. Pretty cool.
So we've got a lot to watch here over the summer. Watch them learning how, and they'll be out on the outside the nest and then leaving, coming back.
Yes, yeah, and actually it's probably downhill from here. Looking at the date and what you described, they're only going to be there a couple more weeks, so you might want to take some time off of work to enjoy the show.
Well, I work at home, so I get to watch them almost all day.
Your productivity is going to go way down, isn't it?
Oh, it already has.
Yeah, well, that's great.
Constantly.
Well, let me tell you, what you're watching is so much better than watching TV. It's like changing the channel every few seconds because there's something different going on with those birds. And then what's really neat is if you have a scope to put it on there to see what mom and dad are bringing. Oh, it's a snake this time, or it's a frog or crayfish or whatever it is. It's really cool.
We've seen that. And you can see them tear it up in front of them and feed them.
And you can tiptoe under the nest later and see what kind of carcasses are there. You might find turtle shells, crawfish tails, fish scales, snake heads, that kind of thing. You'll find remnants of what they're eating because they're not going to eat the undigestibles like, you know, skulls and things. So that's a good way to find out what they're eating is to go under the nest. You might make sure you wait a while because some red-shouldered hawks are pretty aggressive. You probably would know by now if these pair were going to attack or, you know, trying to protect their young. But I bet you can probably tiptoe under there and see what they've been eating.
I think I saw him run off another hawk. I'm not sure. A hawk came close by and he made a beeline for him.
Yeah.
Other
species even. I've seen red-shouldered hawks scare off broadwing hawks, Mississippi kites, barred owls. So, yeah, they know that their young are easy picking, easy lunch, easy dinner, and that those parents have to be really good about keeping peace at the nest.
I've seen blue jays seem to harass them.
Yeah, blue jays sometimes will eat other bird nestlings, and that's the case for a lot of songbirds. But a big nestling like a hawk, they're probably just being blue jays, which a lot of times they're just being pesky and mobbing and just being, you know, like teenagers, just causing trouble.
We call them the thugs of the neighborhood.
Yeah, they are kind of like thugs, but they're good. They're good to have.
Juvenile delinquents.
Yeah,
that's what they seem like. We have some barred owls that I've heard around here, and I read that they're kind of mortal enemies. Owls and hawks.
Well, they're not necessarily that. They're just competing for the same resource. But the good thing is the hawk is in the day, whereas the owl is feeding at night. For the most part, I've seen many barred owls feeding in the daytime or in that dawn dusk period, but they're not mortal enemies. They're just competing for the same resource. Those two raptors are very similar size, going after that same crawfish, that same frog, that same snake.
All right. You have been listening to Bird Calls tonight with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Park and Wildlife Department. We want to thank everyone at Texas Parks and Wildlife for their help with this program. And I personally want to thank, as always, Cliff, for not only joining us tonight, but for allowing me to send him lots of photos and lots of birds that have been annoying me in my roof over the past several months, as well as birds from other folks who have recorded and taken photos. If you have a photograph or a bird sound and would like to have Cliff identify that, you can send it here to the station, redriverradio.org, at my email address, wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. You can also find that online. Again, this has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. I'm your producer, with help from Renee Moran and Wally Derleth, Daniel Gordy, and Henry Edwards, as well as all of our phone volunteers tonight for our fun drive. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website, but not until after the live music show that we're coming up and doing in 30 seconds here. We have Chris Allen and Chris McKay in our studio now. We're going to go to some music here in just a second from them, and we're going to ask you to call in during that program as well at 800-552-8502. Cliff, thanks again for coming in.
Next episode, July 15th.
There you go, coming up. This is Red River Radio from LSUS. This is KDAQ, Shreveport, Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches.